Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the 1980s, 111 First Street in Jersey City was an abandoned P. Lorillard Tobacco Company warehouse, and then a group of artists who'd been priced out of Manhattan real estate moved in. But the new flourishing art scene brought gentrification with it, and the artists were forced into a fierce battle to maintain their place in the neighborhood. David J. Goodwin, a former commissioner and chairman of the Jersey City Historic Preservation Commission, tells that story in his new book from Fordham University Press called Left Bank of the Hudson, Jersey City and the Artists of 111 First Street. Mr. Goodwin, a librarian at the Fordham University School of Law, joins us now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
The Fordham School of Law is located in Manhattan. So what's your connection with Jersey City?
First of all, I just started a new position at Fordham. I'm the assistant director at the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University. Just wanted to point that out. But what's my connection to Jersey City? I've lived in Jersey City for 14 years now. And when I moved to Jersey City, I rode the light rail to gain a sense of the city and its fabric and its texture. And that's how I discovered this building, 111 First Street.
A lot of New Yorkers probably are unfamiliar with Jersey City and its history, but it has some interesting history. It played a role as a passageway for slaves in the Underground Railroad, and many escaped slaves wound up living there. Its role as a metropolitan area shipping hub influenced the making of the 1954 film On the Waterfront. Mm-hmm. Was it shot in Jersey City?
On the Waterfront was shot in Hoboken, New Jersey. But Jersey City itself had a rich, as you point out, shipping and rail history and industry as well, which ties into the building at 111 First Street.
So you spotted the building while you were just doing a tour, but how did you learn the story of 111 First Street?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So when I saw the building, it was in the process of being torn down. So this was in 2007, and I didn't know anything about the building or about its history. I was curious as to why something so architecturally interesting was being demolished. And then I saw a reference on, I believe, a local blog or message board about the arts community at 111 First Street. And that really struck my imagination and really furthered my curiosity as why a building that had housed this community. One, why the community wasn't allowed to remain the building, and then why the building was torn down. But over the years, I was able to gather bits of information here and there. I read an article in a local publication, the Jersey City Magazine, that detailed, it was maybe a 3 or 4 page article talking about the history of this building. And that's when I realized there was a larger story there.
Artists in New York City will recognize this story of gentrification. How different is it from what's happened in a number of New York City neighborhoods, in Soho, the East Village, Chelsea, Dumbo, Williamsburg, when artists have unwittingly paved the way for gentrification?
Well, I think what makes it different in some ways from Soho or Chelsea or Williamsburg is in this neighborhood, it was one building. It was the 111 First Street building. And there's no remains of the artists at this building. The building was torn down. And the community scattered throughout Jersey City, throughout the New York area, and throughout the country, where if we take a trip to Soho or the East Village or Williamsburg, even though those neighborhoods have changed and they're no longer open to artists, at least artists that aren't affluent, there's what I like to call the archaeology of the past there. So you may find record stores or galleries or bookstores or restaurants or bars that still cater to creative communities.
But were the artists living in this building or just using it for studio space?
Both. And that was one of the points of contention, that this building was zoned as an industrial site, but also as an art space, but art studio space. So artists were not legally allowed to be living there.
What do artists see in an area that other people don't that will lead them to move in and then, unfortunately, be hoisted by their own petard with gentrification?
I think there are a few points of attraction. One, the most fundamental, is cheap rent. So artists as a whole are not an affluent group. They earn far less than the average household income. Most of them are independent contractors, so they don't have, say, health insurance, disability insurance, so on and so forth, the sort of benefits many of us take for granted. But also, I think spaces such as 111 First Street or past areas in New York, such as Soho's and Williamsburg, these post-industrial spaces, they carry an aura that I think attracts artists and creative-minded folk, people, that they enjoy working, living and experience a space that was a site of production. Because artists, you could argue, are producers themselves. So in the past, those buildings may have produced televisions or textiles, food products, but now it's books, it's films, it's paintings, it's sculpture.
Also, the buildings themselves lend themselves to being good workspaces for artists. I know every time I've passed an empty former factory or warehouse with artists, they've said, "Oh boy, I wonder if anybody is making that into studio space."
No, I think that's a very good point as well. The practical consideration of space is that they're there's light,
and they usually
air.
Have good electrical wiring and all sorts of other things. But they're often in neighborhoods that are unattractive, considered unsafe. Mm-hmm. So the artists are making the neighborhoods safer?
Well, I think that might be a claim that's a bit overstated. Often in these debates about gentrification and displacement, artists are maybe labeled as the initiators of the process. And I like to say artists are the canaries in the coal mine twice over. The artists are the first to take a chance on a disinvested neighborhood, as you point out. And then if the neighborhood is improving economically, if there is displacement, the artists are often the first group to be pushed out. So,
but people and businesses are attracted to the neighborhood because of what the artists have done. So isn't it ironic that they're the ones who are moved out?
It is. Artists, you could say, clean up the neighborhood or make it safe for capital or those with more means than the artists themselves, or if there are current inhabitants in the neighborhood.
So since gentrification brings higher housing and studio costs, and that leads to many of the artists being displaced from the places that they've made attractive to others, has anyone proposed a better alternative, a way to make things work economically for these developing communities?
That's something I've been thinking about a lot since my book came out, and I've been talking with people and doing programs such as your program today, or speaking in front of audiences at bookstores, is what can be done to ensure that neighborhoods such as the community at 111 First Street or a neighborhood in New York
Does that neighborhood have a name other than
The neighborhood is called, ironically enough, the Powerhouse Arts District. That neighborhood was zoned first in 1996 to be an arts neighborhood. The buildings were supposed to maintain a certain density and height in line with the structures there at the time, which were largely post-Civil War era warehouses. And they were supposed to be catered to artists and art-related industries. There was supposed to be arts housing, space for arts businesses. But at this point in time in that neighborhood, the Powerhouse Arts District, there's very little semblance of arts or the creative community that was there. That may be changing at the slightly. There's a dance school, the Nimbus Dance School, that's slated to be developed in that area. So hopefully that augurs a positive change.
You served as commissioner of the Jersey City Historic Preservation Commission. How did you wind up becoming commissioner?
Well, that's an interesting story as well. So my wife and I purchased a home in Jersey City in 2010. And I think, as is the case with many people when they put down roots, I wanted to become involved in the neighborhood, in the city. And there was an open call for seats on various local commissions at City Hall. And there was a nonprofit educating individuals how to apply for these commissions and how to approach city officials on being the commissions. And the Historic Preservation Commission was listed on this list of various commissions. And I applied, and I was interviewed by the mayor and several of his staff members at that time. And I'm appointed to the commission. I served in the commission for several years. And as a matter of fact, during my tenure, buildings in the Powerhouse Arts District came up for historical designation. Now, they were designated historical buildings several years in the past and then stripped of that designation as the fight for that 111 First Street and its neighborhood really sped up.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that whole business in a little while.
It's confusing.
But working on the commission change the way you think about historic landmarks?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Did it change the way I think?
Because we assume that the really interesting historic landmarks are protected by law. And then, as we will learn from the story, that's not always the case.
No. Well, one, it's how much teeth there is to the landmark law. So whether a locale in the sense of Jersey City, or we're sitting in New York today, or another city is willing to stand by the rulings of their commission and the decisions they have made, which is not always the place. But one, I did gain more sympathy to small businesses and homeowners coming forth to these commissions where, you know, I think many people, including myself, when we're talking about issues of preservation, landmarks, the demolition of landmarks, we're thinking of a David and Goliath situation where the city or the Landmarks Commission is standing up against large developers or now, you know, global conglomerates. But many times it's homeowners, small business people who don't have the resources necessarily to invest in the preservation. So I gain more sympathy for individuals.
Well, in New York, most people date the deciding moment with the destruction of Penn Station.
Yes.
But I had a friend who, an elderly friend who's unfortunately no longer with us, and she told me when there was talk of knocking down the Lever House, she said, "Oh, gee, I picketed the destruction of the building that the Lever House replaced, and now I'm going to have to go and picket to defend the Lever House."
Right, so the idea that cities are always changing. That's something that's lost in these debates about landmarks and preservation.
And some of our finest buildings replaced really nice buildings in New York City. On the other hand, right now, it doesn't seem to be that way. They're just these tall, ugly things that are going up. And in Jersey as well.
Right. Well, in Jersey City, specifically, there's been much debate about demolition and teardowns. And the city just changed its local demolition ordinance last year where any demolition order has to be approved by the historic preservation officer, where in the past it just went through the buildings department. So at least there's some check to slow that process down.
So this is a local thing in almost every case.
Yes.
And the local area has to decide whether what's going to replace this historic site is actually going to be an improvement, bring in jobs, whatever. Mm-hmm. We're having a big fight right now in Queens over whether Amazon should be given a site.
Right.
And the big fight there is largely about gentrification as well. Suddenly people will be priced out of their homes. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with David J. Goodwin, whose book, Left Bank of the Hudson, Jersey City, and the Artists of 111 First Street, is published by Fordham University Press. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. So let's talk about the building. The P. Lorillard Tobacco Company was founded by a French immigrant in 1760. When did they move to Jersey City?
So the company moved to Jersey City in the late 1860s, from 1866 to 1956, the Lorillard Company was housed. Well, the manufacturing plant was housed at 111 First Street. And it's an interesting story about this company as well. It started in the Wall Street area, and the founder, Pierre Lorillard, was killed during a prison break in the American Revolution. That was right on Catham Street. And there's some dispute whether he was murdered by British soldiers or he was murdered by the prisoners or he just a stray bullet caught him. The family claims that it was an act of murder because he was a rabid patriot, but that may be just a family tall tale. After the revolution, the manufacturing plant moved to the Bronx, where the Botanical Garden is today, and the mill that the factory uses is still part of the Botanical Garden. It's the old stone mill. And the family deeded that to the city of New York and deeded what is now the Thane Family Forest, which is an old-growth forest in the Botanical Garden.
And it had some pretty famous brands, Old Gold's,
yep, Lucky Strike. Kent,
Kool's, Lucky Strike.
Yes, yeah.
Now it's, I think it's been sold off in pieces and rental zones.
R.J. Reynolds, yes.
So, but because it was big, that meant that when they opened the factory in Jersey City, that was probably an important event, meant a lot of jobs.
Sure, it was a huge employer in the area. And I've met people that recall family members working there as late as the 1960s. And it was a huge building. It was roughly 200,000 square feet. There were, and I have an illustration in the book as well of the building from that time. There were sub-buildings. And that area at that time was a huge shipping and warehousing district. And that was part of the reason the company wanted to locate in Jersey City. It had access to the docks. It had access to the rail. Had access to the slaughterhouses, which animal bladders were a key ingredient of making, I believe, snuff tobacco at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was a huge employer, and I detail the history of the company in one chapter, and it was actually, oddly enough, a very paternalistic or beneficent employer, where it was ahead of its time in many ways than we are today, where they actually offered daycare to their employees.
Mostly immigrant
yes.
employees. Yes. Now, what was Jersey City like? It was just a blue-collar town when they built this factory?
Well, Jersey City, as we know it, wasn't even fully incorporated when the factory was built. So Jersey City was incorporated, I believe, in 1870. And
well, around that time.
Around that time, yes. Mm-hmm. And so what was it? It was largely a manufacturing and blue-collar town, and that's largely been Jersey City's identity until recently as a blue-collar town, an immigrant town. Ellis Island is right across, really, right, mm-hmm. sitting right adjacent to Jersey City in the bay. So
you can see the Statue of Liberty from
the Statue
Jersey
of Liberty,
City as well.
Which there's always been dispute over whether New York or New Jersey owns the Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island. Well, Ellis Island's federal property. So, and also, Jersey City was a huge rail hub. So there was three... the Erie Railroad was in Jersey City, the Central Rail of New Jersey, and the Lackawanna, I believe. So
that's because of the proximity to the ports.
The proximity to the port. And up until Penn Station, there was no rail service into Manhattan. So anyone who wanted from Manhattan that wanted to travel into the interior of the United States would take a ferry across the river to either Hoboken or Jersey City.
There are still ferries, aren't there?
There are still ferries, yes, but it's residential now for commuters. It's not, you know, ferrying people across the river to get the rail terminals or other shipping hubs.
You mentioned that you have an illustration of it in the book, although most of our listeners don't have the book. So can you describe it? Is it like most abandoned warehouses? Or was it? I mean, it isn't. It doesn't exist
well,
anymore.
Well, it doesn't. Yeah. Well, one, it doesn't exist anymore, as you pointed out. So
I mean, if I were to be traveling by it, would I say, wow, that's a really interesting looking building?
I think when the building was standing, you would say that. It was Greco-Roman Revival area, Greco-Roman Revival architectural style, built in that style. It was, I believe, 4 to 5 stories high. It took up a massive super block, again, around 200,000 square feet. And it was abandoned. So Lower Lard, as we just discussed, left the factory in 1956, and it was largely banned until the early to mid-80s. There was some light industry and other manufacturers and businesses in there, but nothing you could really point to and say this is going to result in a vibrant rebirth of industry. And then in the late 1980s, the first artists began to move into this building, and it was marketed exclusively towards artists. I found an ad in the Village Voice that was taken out in the Village Voice, marketing this building exclusively towards artists. But the owner never really did much work on the building in its entire life as an arts community. And it, so
who owned the building at that time?
At that time, a company known as New Gold Equities. Now I believe it's known as BLDG. And the owner of that company was a gentleman by the name of Lloyd Goldman, who was a figure in Manhattan real estate for several decades, he was involved in the World Trade Center site as well.
He became the primary owner of the building in 1991.
Yes. He bought bankruptcy court.
And do we know who Lloyd Goldman is?
He's a financier and a real estate developer, and largely in Manhattan. His current company is, as I believe I mentioned, is BLDG. I think BLDG Management is what it's named now. He helped finance the World Trade Center site. So he is a very wealthy man, a billionaire. So when Larry Silverstein looked to refinance to rebuild World Trade Center site, he looked to Goldman to help him with the financing. So that might give your listeners a sense of his wealth and caliber. But it's interesting. I mean, when we think of Manhattan real estate, we're thinking these larger-than-life figures. But most of the time, I think many of the developers or the real men or women in authority are rather in the background. And he's one of these people in the background that you don't read about in the press, that you don't hear about in the tabloids.
One of the key figures in the story is former Jersey City Mayor Brett Schundler.
Mm-hmm.
The Waldo, which stands for Work and Live District Overlay mm-hmm. Zoning Ordinance, was passed under him in 1996. And what did the ordinance call for?
So the ordinance is what codified this neighborhood. It was called Waldo, later became the Powerhouse Arts District, as an arts neighborhood, as a district geared to the arts, to creative industries. So one, it dictated that all construction, all rehabilitation in the district needed to follow the guidelines already set. So as we discussed, these warehouses and structures in the neighborhood were largely post-Civil War era warehouses, 4 to 5 stories. So anything new had to adhere to that density. It also mandated that the majority of the housing be designated for artists, so a degree of subsidized housing. It also dictated that majority of new businesses be arts-related businesses. I believe if that zoning had been allowed to actually work, the neighborhood, the Powerhouse Arts District, would be, in effect, a true arts district today.
And I was going to say, I imagine that this was a positive step, because here you have this area that once was thriving, mm-hmm. but because of changes in transportation and the way business is done, and the fact that cigarette companies that all moved to the south,
mm-hmm.
this was a way to revive the neighborhood and make it into something special. Was it seen that way at the time?
I think you describe it quite wonderfully, actually, as an attempt to make this neighborhood special and a way to shape the city to face the new emerging economy. So to step away from its industrial blue-collar past and discover what's next for it, whether that be arts, whether that be creative industries, whether that be, you know, some other work. But the artists certainly saw it as positive. I think that the surrounding area saw it as positive, but it more or less sort of stayed still until late early 2000s. So it was never put to the test until then.
But people recognize that 111 First was described as, quote, the epicenter of the art world in Jersey mm-hmm. City, and a place that allowed artists to freely pursue their dreams as mm-hmm. creative individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So people were buying into this.
Yes.
But then the relationship between the artists and management soured around 2000.
Mm-hmm.
What happened then?
So I think several things happened. One, you had 9/11. And you had an exodus of jobs from Lower Manhattan to Jersey City. So all of a sudden you had the area around the Powerhouse Arts District. So to sketch it out for your listeners too, the Powerhouse Arts District is basically a stone's throw from the Hudson River. And the Jersey City waterfront was already being redeveloped. And then I guess the next layer would be the Powerhouse Arts District. So you had businesses, you had development that may or may not have been in Manhattan, now gravitating towards Jersey City. So the real estate all of a sudden became exponentially more expensive.
And more valuable.
So all of a sudden, the owner, I think, decided he wanted to maximize his profit. And then there was a slow and steady push to remove the artists from the building.
Wasn't there an issue involving a curfew?
There was a curfew. At one point, they attempted to have a curfew. I can't remember when it was closing on the weekday, but they wanted it to be closed on weekends. I think it was 9 to 5 or 9 to 6. And anyone who's a practicing artist knows that most artists do not make their living by their art alone. So they work on evenings, they work on holidays, they work on weekends. And having a curfew basically cuts them off at the knees as far as artists and also as far as small business people, because artists are trying to make a living through their art, by the sale of their art, by performing their art. And so not only was it attacking them as individuals, as tenants, but it was attacking them as business people as well.
And as you said, they were some of them were living there.
Yes, well, there's that as well.
It's hard to live with a curfew.
Right.
What happens if you want to go out to dinner? The artists saw themselves as the last of the Mohegans in their fight against what they described as the insatiable forces of progress. Mm-hmm. And they said that they didn't want to fall victim to the cycle of gentrification. Mm-hmm. So they obviously went to City Hall. Mm-hmm. And what happened?
Well, it was a long, drawn-out battle. It took place over several years. So it really started, as we just discussed, when the owner imposed a curfew. And that is when
he started raising rents, too.
He started raising rents arbitrarily, sometimes doubled it, sometimes tripled it.
And he could get away with that? There's no rent control laws?
Well, these were all commercial tenants. So once the lease expired, there's no control over commercial rents in New Jersey. And in few places, actually. New York, I don't believe, has any commercial rent control. And at that time in Jersey City, the City Hall was more or less, if not fully aligned with the artists. They were sympathetic to the artists. So this would have been the Glenn Cunningham administration in Jersey City.
He was a long time mayor.
He was a long-time political figure. He was a freeholder. He was a city council person. He was in his early years of his mayorality when 111 First Street really came to a head. And he would often approach the owner about the rents, and the rents would go down thanks to his interference or advocacy, if you would like to call it that. But it was a constant back and forth that the owner would, you know, chipping away at the artists, and the artists would try to fight back. But I'm getting a little confused myself.
Well,
it's a long, involved story.
Well, Mayor Cunningham commissioned a nonprofit research organization, the Urban Land Institute, to develop a plan for the area. And what did they come up with?
Well, they are the ones first that came up with the name Powerhouse Arts District. They advocated for rechristening the neighborhood Powerhouse Arts District. They advocated for much of the elements already contained in the Waldo Ordinance or proposed by the artists and their advocates and supporters. So gearing the neighborhood towards arts, to arts businesses, to creative industries, gearing it to what at that time, what now we would call the creative class, having some sort of set asides for artist housing. However, the only element of that whole plan by the Urban Land Institute that was instituted was the name. Mm-hmm. So City Hall never followed through on any of these plans. So was the plan just a mask for City Hall to show that it was supporting the artists and the art community, but then actually not doing anything? Because, again, we were talking about preservation, now we're talking about artists, it really comes down to what is the wherewithal of the government at the time, whether they're willing to go to bat for any given community.
Well, it still was more than what we see in some other places like New York City, where artists right now are being pushed out of all of the
Everywhere.
Neighborhoods. And a lot of them are moving up the Hudson River to towns like Hudson and Kingston, which are benefiting from these artists, but you can only wonder what's going to happen 15, 20 years from now when people in Hudson decide to follow what we've seen in Jersey City and in New York City.
Right. That's something I've worried about myself, is what is the future
for New York? Is Detroit next?
Well, that's what Patti Smith said, right? She said, what would you recommend to an artist in New York? Move to Detroit. That's something I really worry about, the long-term health of the arts and various creative industries in the New York area, is as everything's become exponentially so expensive, will there still be generations of young artists, or not so young artists, that move here and try to make a name and a career for themselves? Yeah. I mean, I think New York will always have art institutions, you know, museums, performing arts centers, theaters, but we always have the minor leagues, if you want to call it that, of the arts. And that, I would argue, is really the true sign of health of a creative community. Is there a vibrancy? Is there an injection of new ideas, new voices?
There was a time when it was thought that if you wanted to be a serious artist, you had to move to the New York metropolitan area. That's no longer the case. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Tonight I'm gonna take that ride across the river to the Jersey side. Take my baby to the carnival, then I'll take her on all the rides. 'Cause down the shore everything's alright. You and your baby on a Saturday night. Now you know all my dreams come true when I'm walking down the street with you.
The arts tend to get short shrift on the media, we feel here on this show, Leonard Lopate at Large, that they are an important part of our lives, and we are very happy to put them in the mix of things that we discuss. When and that's something that listeners have told me that they really appreciate. When I began broadcasting again on WBAI last July, many of my long-term listeners wrote to me to say how pleased they were that I'd come here and was doing this kind of show that wasn't just what the president said yesterday, and you bring in a panel and you say, so what do you think this means and what does the future portend? I'm actually trying to talk about other things that are important, although politics always comes into these discussions, but I just don't want to repeat what everybody else is doing. And I've been told that this is something that listeners are really appreciating. And they said that they wanted to support WBAI by becoming members of the station. Well, if you're one of them, thank you very much for all the support. It really made me feel very good during a very difficult time in my life. But if you haven't gotten around to making that contribution, this is really a good time to do it because WBAI is in the midst of its winter fund drive, currently scheduled to run for the entire month of February, and it could even go longer if we don't meet our goal of $300,000. Now, $300,000 in most big city radio, public radio stations is really small potatoes, but that's what we're asking for. It's just we're trying to do things like build a new studio. We've only recently been able to expand our phone lines and be able to take calls on the air. And we have the usual expenses that you know about. We have to pay utility bills. We have to pay rent. We have to pay for our antenna and the like. Other radio stations, public radio stations, often run what we might call ads, although they don't call them ads, and they call them funding credits. But you know that they're ads, and we think that that kind of would muddies the water when you're trying to do run a radio station that remains totally independent. In Great Britain, the way they've taken care of it is everyone has to pay a £90 licensing fee, which comes to around $120 a year. It's the same amount we ask you to give to become a WBAI buddy, which is would be $10 a month, except BAI listeners like you are on the honor system. You do it because you want to support us and because you believe in what we're doing. So please don't wait. Make that call right now to 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Or give to WBAI.org. That's give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. And if you become a WBAI sustaining member, we will show our appreciation by sending you a year subscription to Harper's Magazine. Harper's is I'm sure you know about Harper's. It's this fabulous museum magazine that covers a wide range of issues, the arts and politics and science and finance and pretty much everything else that we will find of interest. So it's a great gift that we can give to you, but we can only give it to you if you become a member for $10 or more. We hope that you'll call right now. Again, the number is 516-620-3602. We appreciate whatever way you give because WBI really needs your support, and frankly, so do I. So call now. And let's get back to our show, in which we're talking about, I think we probably have a fair number of listeners in Jersey City.
I would imagine.
but this is a story, as we've been pointing out, that really resonates pretty much everywhere and definitely resonates throughout the all of the metropolitan area. Going through similar kinds of traumas as property values go up. We were talking about the mayor at the time, Mayor Cunningham, who tended to side with the artists against developers, although you say that no real actions were done. Were his hands tied?
Well, what happened with Cunningham, I think, is his term in office was relatively short. He had died of a massive heart attack in, if I remember,
2004.
So your facts are better than mine.
No, although I've written some things down.
And that, I think, largely sealed the deal for the artists of 111 First Street.
Because the people who succeeded him weren't as committed.
They were not as committed. It was Schindler picked the artists at 111 First Street up as his issue, and he was advocating for them. One source informed me that right before Cunningham died, he was in the process of negotiating long-term leases for the artists with Lloyd Goldman and his company New Gold Equities. Once he died, there was a special election within several months. The acting mayor at that time made promises to the artists that he, in reality, I don't believe, could execute upon. He was talking about eminent domain, and at that time, there was a very strict definition of eminent domain. So this is before Kalo versus City of New London in 2005, that Supreme Court ruling. And at that time, eminent domain, there had to be some public good. Now it's much more loose.
So,
interesting, and depending on your point of view, conflicted. Many of the artists whom I spoke with blame Healy for their eviction from the building and the eventual demolition of the building. However, Jeremiah Healy was elected in November. The artists were evicted in early 2005, January 2005. So he was elected in November 2004. January 2005, they were evicted. I think Mayor Healy viewed this as his predecessor's issue, not his problem. He had a different set of political priorities. He wanted to move on those priorities. Also, I wonder if he was concerned about launching eminent domains proceedings that would ultimately fail, and then you're setting a precedent for future conflicts with other landowners throughout the city. But then also, I believe he was concerned about basically the city putting up funds, resources, and a fight for one constituency, and then that would be precedent in any time a situation like 111 First Street or another community or another group of individuals came to City Hall with their conflicts with a large landowner. The city would be in the position of maybe having to support them when they may not want to.
So after the artists were evicted at 111, didn't a second battle to preserve the building as a historic landmark develop?
Yes. So we've talked a little about historical designations and landmarks. So 111 First Street and several other buildings in the Powerhouse Arts District were landmark historic in 2005. The owner of 111 First Street and several other property owners in that neighborhood immediately filed suit against the city. And this involved several years of various court cases, fines, so on and so forth. And the city stripped 111 First Street of its historical designation, thus allowing its demolition. If it was designated.
So it actually caved into the
It caved into the developers, yes. So
did they see the alternative, which was a skyscraper? What is it, a 52-story skyscraper?
This is what they proposed. Today, that property, 111 First Street, is still a vacant lot. Has not been developed.
So it's not generating any revenue for the city. They've actually shot themselves in the foot.
The city, and that is one of the questions that have come out of this story, is why is this piece of property still vacant? And that is a question I do not have an answer for. If I had a conversation with Mr. Goldman, the property owner, that would be my first question, is why is this still vacant? But yes, there was a fight to preserve this as a historical landmark, and that is where the ire directed against the former Mayor Healey, I think, is correct, that he may have not been in a position to preserve 111 as an artist community, but it could have been preserved as a historic landmark, and it could have been rehabilitated into, if not an arts community, but some sort of creative industry or just apartments and businesses.
Well, considering its long history, it's really shocking that an attempt to make 111 First Street a historic landmark failed. After all, it played a major role in the story of Jersey City. Many of the artists that you interview for your book claim that the spirit of 111 lives on. In what way?
I think, how does it live on? I think, one, this book is a testament that it lives on, that this story is gaining a place and maybe the local folklore of Jersey City, I think a place in the folklore of Jersey City is one as an opportunity the city let pass by. This was, at the time, 111 First Street as an arts community was the largest concentration of working artists outside of West Beth, which is in Manhattan, on the East Coast.
West Beth, by the way, has gone through its own problems over the years. I guess artists, people want the artists and they don't want the artists.
Right, right. They want them, but then they want to develop the property. Also, I think 111 First Street is a testament or an example of what not to do for activists, for city government. And I think if there's one major takeaway from the story of 111 First Street, of the story of the artists and of my book, is if you live in a community that is anticipating gentrification or experiencing gentrification, whether you're an artist, whether you're a member of one group or another, this is what not to let happen to you. And this is how a city should not conduct itself in relationship with property owners, relationship with citizens, relationship with activists. So it's failed policy, and it was largely mistakes made. There were many mistakes made by the artists and the activists as well. So it's an illustrative case of what not to do, unfortunately.
In 2017, more than 40 alums of 111 came together to show their work in an exhibit called 111 First Street, a community of artists. Mm-hmm. What was the response in Jersey City?
That was a great exhibit. I was fortunate enough to be part of that exhibit as well. So
were people proud to say, wow, we had some pretty good artists living here that we just forced to leave?
I think so. So this was about a year and some months ago, and it was in the studio space of a former resident of 111 First Street. She opened up her studio space to these artists. And for me, it's exciting because many of these artists I had met or just corresponded with during the course of writing my book. So it's the first time I was able to meet them. But also, if I was an outsider, someone who did not know anything about 111 First Street, this was an opportunity to see the artwork, to meet the artists, and then hear a discussion about the book. So you had maybe the beginning, the middle, and the end of this story. It was we had quite a few people come through this exhibit in a 2-day period. It was open. It was actually extended the show for another week or two, if I remember correctly. It was covered in the local paper. The New York Star Ledger wrote an article about it, the exhibit. So I think it was a good send-off for the artist and show, again, what was going on in that building and what was lost.
Well, have most of the artists moved out of Jersey City?
Most of the artists have scattered. Some of the artists are still in Jersey City. Some are in the Hudson River Valley, as you pointed out, in Hudson and Kingston, some of the other towns. Some are, have left to other parts of the country. I know one artist who actually just sent me a nice message on Facebook last night wishing me luck for today. He lives in Houston. Mm-hmm. So, yes, people scattered, and it was really was the nucleus of the arts community in Jersey City. And it, if it had been allowed to stay or remain in some shape, I think the city would have a much more vibrant arts community, but also a truly vibrant arts industry that I don't think we have, where there's not film studios, there are not graphic design studios, you know, art-related professions, which you might see in Brooklyn or other parts of New York City, but we don't really have in Jersey City.
There are film studios in Greenpoint that are being forced out as well.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah. Well, it's shrinking.
Shrink.
Atlanta right now is where you where people are making movies.
Tax credits.
How did you choose Left Bank of the Hudson to be the title of your book?
Oh, well, that the credit for that goes to my editor.
The reason I ask is you've been a librarian, yes. And I've always wondered how important the title of a book is.
I think the title is extremely important. The title, if you think about it, is your marketing pitch, your tagline. And I came up with some titles. But my editor-in-chief, he picked this title, and I think it's a great title. Many people, including such as yourself, have said, that's a really great book title. Where did that come from? And I'd like to take credit, but I cannot.
Well, you recognize that it was a good idea when it was suggested to you. You currently serve as a board member of the Jersey City Landmarks Conservancy?
Correct.
What are some of the current hot-button issues facing the city nowadays?
So preservation issues considered to be a hot-button issue. For our organization, we advocate for historic rehabilitation, historic preservation, instead of demolition. So at the beginning of the program, we talked about a new demolition ordinance that Jersey City enacted. We advocate for that. There is a discussion of the demolition of St. Peter's Grammar School in the Paulus Hook neighborhood of Jersey City, which other board members are involved in that debate. I'm not involved in that debate. We also are putting together as an organization events throughout Jersey City, cultural events. We've done that in the last year. We had a history of the indie rock scene in Hudson County in Jersey City. We had a program about Washington Irving and his relationship to Jersey City, New Jersey.
Washington Irving lived in New Jersey? In Jersey
he did not live in Jersey City, but he traveled through Jersey City. He had a friend who lived in an area that's now part of Newark, New Jersey. In the early part of his life, he and his friends would take a ferry across the Hudson River, travel through Jersey City to his friend's house, in which is now, I believe it's in the Forest Hill neighborhood of Jersey City. We were talking about Newark, New Jersey before the program. But what are some of the other hot-button issues? I think the vibrancy of the arts community is a very big issue in Jersey City right now. There is a nonprofit organization, the Jersey City Arts Council, which has come together just for that, to advocate for the art, to lobby city government, to lobby state government. There was a piece of legislation that was just passed in New Jersey State Assembly to allow municipalities to levy a small property tax to fund arts organizations. So if that ultimately makes its way through the Senate and is signed by New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, that could be a positive for Jersey City and other municipalities. But I think the main hot button issue, and this relates to not only artists, but I think most people living in the metropolitan area, is affordability and inequality. And how, if artists cannot find affordable spaces to live and work, having wonderful art institutions isn't enough. And I think that's probably the biggest issue facing Jersey City, but the entire New York area, is affordability. Yeah.
People are being moved out of – people used to move to Brooklyn because it was less expensive, and now they can't afford Brooklyn.
They're getting pushed out of Brooklyn.
But what's your sense of the general public's thinking on all of this? Do they even pay much attention to what was happening? The other residents of Jersey City, did they see this as an important issue, or was this just something that was being fought between real estate interests, the politicians, and the artists?
My sense, it was an issue for a subset of the population. but not for the city at large. And especially at this time, as we talked about, this area, the Powerhouse Arts District, was in a sort of a weird marginal area between the waterfront and the downtown at large. So many people didn't even walk in the neighborhood or traverse in the neighborhood. So did the public, was the public at large aware what was going on 111 First Street? I would suspect not. I think now, though, artists are in a unique position to become more engaged with citywide organizations in Jersey City or other cities as gentrification, displacement, affordability has become a concern for the general population, where 10, 20 years ago, it was a very marginal issue. Like you pointed out, the fight for 111 may have been a marginal issue. But I think affordability, gentrification, displacement has went from being a very academic concern to being a shared concern.
What about the other argument that's made, that as much as we would like to preserve historic landmarks, progress requires that sometimes we have to make way for new construction and design? Mm-hmm.
That's true. Not everything can be saved. Not everything preserved. But shouldn't we want to save some element of our past? And I think what is valuable at a place such as 111 First Street or another arts community or a unique building or unique structure is these are the elements that make our cities and neighborhoods interesting. These are what imbue them with value. And if we strip away that value, do we want to live in those places? I mean, to me, it's a question of values.
And we're seeing this in downtown Brooklyn, where there have been a whole bunch of high-rises have gone up. When I say high-rises, skyscrapers, 50-story buildings. And they're rather expensive, but at the same time, they're all fighting to because there are so many vacancies. But an area becomes hot, suddenly everybody wants to build in it, and then well, maybe the rents will come down eventually.
I hope.
Left Bank of the Hudson is your first book. You write that a first book is not the product of a few years, but of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. So does that mean that you've already you've given up on the idea of doing a second book? Because I know you write regularly for a website called anothertownonthehudson.com.
Yes. No, I am currently a resident at the New York Public Library in the Wertheim Study, where I am researching what I hope to be my second book. But as I said, the first book is a product of a lifetime. And in this book, I threw in every tidbit of information, every trick, every anecdote, everything that I had. And I gave myself some time to rest. The last year and a half, I've been promoting this book. I've been doing book events, coming on programs such as yours, Leonard, and just meeting people and talking to them about this book, which I think will make me a better author, I hope, as I gear up for round two.
In the end, the sad part of the story is I think almost everyone agrees that the arts are an important part of what makes a community special and vibrant, and yet at the same time we don't do much to help the artists. I guess we're more interested in the ones who are long dead or are so rich that they don't have to live in these areas.
Right. So support for the arts in the United States is relatively meager. If you look at the National Endowment for the Arts budget, that's
in other
a
countries,
fraction of what
in
is
other
in
countries,
France.
You graduate from art school, and then the government actually will help you for a few years financially.
Right. I know in Germany there are programs for that. I believe in France as well. But there are many ways the government could make the practice of art easier. It could be tax policy. I know in the state of Rhode Island, the sale of original artworks is tax-free. It could be providing resources to artists. So one positive thing going on in Jersey City now is the Office of Cultural Affairs is offering workshops and programs to pair artists up with grant organizations to show them what government services may or may not be available to them, to educate them on how to apply for funding at the state level, at the foundation level, to provide them with some professional development as to learn how to be small business people. So that's one way. Also, there's an organization in New York City, 596 Acres, which tries to reclaim vacant land for gardens and for parks.
Although they're under attack as well.
They're under attack. That could be done for vacant city property. So there's New York City, Jersey City, Newark, New Jersey. All these cities own property they're not using. That property could be reactivated art spaces or space for arts-related businesses. Also, in the case of 111 First Street in the Powerhouse Arts District or other districts in other cities, there are developers that are interested in building housing or structures for artists and arts-related businesses. So it could be taking the time to find the right people to work with. But ultimately, I mean, we've been talking about affordability. I think what it really comes down to is inclusionary zoning, is some set affordable housing. That's the only way to have a vibrant art community in a growing city such as New York or Jersey City.
David J. Goodwin's Left Bank of the Hudson, Jersey City, and the Artists of 111 First Street is published by Fordham University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, thank you so much, Leonard. It was an honor and a pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to David Goodwin, to Kate Guan, who produced today's segment, to my producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls today, and to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music. Also, I'd like you to know that I'm here every weekday at WBAI from 1 to 2 p.m., and you can hear all of our past shows streaming on demand at BAI.org. We're available as an iTunes podcast, and don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter, and at our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com. I'm here every weekday from 1 to 2 p.m. doing the kind of in-depth conversations of the sort that are quite rare in radio. Of the sort that you heard today, by the way, and we hope you enjoy this new format of one subject in an hour. But as you might imagine, putting a show like this together takes a lot of work, also requires money. We are in the process of building a new studio, and we finally got our new phone system installed, so we've been able to take your calls. But on top of those sizable expenses, we still have rent, utility, and antenna charges, all the sorts of things that you might expect. So we're counting on you for show support so we can continue doing this. And if you become a sustaining member for $10 a month or more by the end of this week, we would be happy to send you a one-year subscription to Harper's Magazine, a source for a lot of the topics we discuss on this show. It's also been a personal source for years for me to because it has this great long-form feature reporting. I'd love to be able to have that print edition sent to you as a way of saying thanks for supporting the programming we do here at Leonard Lopate at Large. So why not give us a call now at 516-620-3602 to become a sustaining member. Or if you $10 a month is too much or whatever, you can make a donation for any amount that you feel comfortable with. You can also go to the web to give to WBAI.org. That's give and then the number 2, WBAI.org. It's especially important not just because you'll be getting that free one-year subscription to Harper's, but also because you know that you want to make sure that we will be here bringing you these one-hour deep dive interviews every weekday. And we appreciate whichever way you you give, because WBI really needs that show of support. Again, that number is 516-620-3602. I'm Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.